Hi, welcome to another episode of Camp COVID. My name is Adam, and if this is your first time listening, I'm taking this whole quarantine opportunity to talk to a bunch of scientists and people that I know. We're gonna do this, using some sort of FaceTime or Skype or whatever. And this week I talked to Dr. Carmela Padvic Callahan. So Carmela and I met at a science communication conference just outside Washington, D.C., in 2019, and we became Twitter friends, and we've been chatting back and forth. And recently, Carmela was at another conference, and we connected, and we chatted a little bit about the new way that conferences are happening, this whole virtual conference thing. And just science communication stuff in general. So I hope you enjoy.
Hello.
Hi, how's it
Can you hear
going?
me? Good. How are
Yeah,
you?
good.
Let me get rid of this virtual background so I don't look like I'm in a hot dog stand.
It. That's cool.
It's from our wedding because we sort of got married very quickly and ended up taking half four pictures on the Brooklyn Bridge, and you can't avoid the hot dog stand on the Brooklyn Bridge.
That's nice.
Yeah. How are you doing with everything, I guess? I don't even know what we're asking people for chit chat now because
Yeah, I feel like people are saying, "Oh, how you holding up?" But that feels like such an uncle thing to say.
yeah, right.
I'm surviving. It's fine. I'm keeping busy and everything. So, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm like at my in-laws' basement, and I guess this is where I'm gonna be for another month, so that's kind of wild, but
Yeah.
teaching, doing a lot of organizing things, so keeping busy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't, it's hard to believe all of this just happened. I don't know. It's weird.
No, I'm fully with you. It like seemed like not a big thing, and then all of a sudden it was a huge thing, and now this is our new normal.
Yeah.
New normal is always very difficult, so.
How are you for productivity? I know a lot of academia people in academia are like sort of yo-yoing on like feeling good some days and then just being completely unproductive. Is that sort of the trajectory you're going through?
I'm sort of in this weird stage where I've defended my thesis, so my productivity is a little bit up to me, except that I have three publications that are like just on the edge of being done. So I've
Okay.
also sort of yo-yoed between like doing a lot of teaching work, because adjusting to teaching online is somehow a huge mountain to scale. And also like doing furious editing of paper manuscripts, which I think I've never actually been good at. So this time has maybe given me a little bit of more peace of mind to like actually focus on my scientific writing. But yeah, some days I'm just sort of like, what is
Yeah.
happening?
As far as teaching is going, are you sort of doing it live? Are you pre-recording stuff or?
We're mostly doing Zoom. So the class that I teach is very large. It's like 300 people, 400 people. And the way it usually works is like there's lectures and there's discussions and there's labs and there's homeworks and pre-lectures. It's like one of those classes where you do a little bit every day, sort of to keep you in the loop. And I teach discussion, which in person means that I give like a 15-minute lecture tops and then I walk around tables and help people problem solve.
Okay.
So that doesn't quite translate to not being in like some level of synchronous. It's a little hard because right, so I'm at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, which is very large and has a big international population, and some people are just stuck in a time zone where they can't possibly make my discussion section anymore. But for the ones that they can, I'm sort of sharing my screen and trying to write in time and preparing a lot of notes and trying to figure out if I can like LaTeX in real time so they can see me write equations, and they
Right.
won't talk to me. We're doing a lot of chatting, but trying to figure out how to keep as much interactivity as we can.
Yeah. Are they does it seem like they're taking to it pretty well? Are they engaging with you and like happy to be online and everything or?
I think there's some selection bias in the sense that people who show up are people who want to engage with me.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, you know, my sections are usually about 24 people. Now that we're online, I'm getting maybe like 12, 13 people a section. And out of those 12, 13, like 5 or 6 are people who really want to talk to me. And the rest of them are just sort of like probably doing something else and watching in the background to see when I'm going to flash solutions. Which is fine. Honestly, I am surprised anyone is still showing up. I know this is a very stressful situation for a lot of people, and a lot of people are probably like home with younger siblings and whatnot. And like, I don't expect them to be as interactive as they would be if I were actually standing over their shoulder. Mm-hmm. So I think they're getting out of it what they feel like they need to get out of it. And if I can provide that, I'm fine.
Yeah. I've seen some people suggest the idea of turning all of these courses that aren't totally finished yet into pass-fail rather than grades. Have you heard anything like that? Is that what your school is doing, or?
Yeah, so it's a little complicated because turns out that for some courses, especially courses that have a lab component, a lot of times like a major requirement is not satisfied if it's pass-fail. So right. We teach a lot of pre-meds and engineers, and it turns out restrictions on courses that satisfy a particular requirement are more tricky than we thought. Having said that, there has been some movement, like the Faculty Senate sort of put forward a proposal for maybe turning a lot of classes pass-fail. Our grad assistants are unionized, teaching assistants are unionized. And our union has also been trying to push for some more, let's say, a bigger margin for when you could decide something is pass-fail or not. The university's kind of extended the deadline here or there, but
right, okay.
the concern is right that, you know, students can now opt to take classes pass-fail as individuals for a longer time, but the onus is still on them to go out of their way and be like, I would like to take this class pass-fail, which still looks bad on their transcript rather than everyone getting a pass-fail grade. So we've been, so I'm involved with the union, so we've sort of been having this conversation of what a reasonable way to advocate for it is without screwing someone over, because some people might actually really need a grade on their transcript too, so.
Interesting. I wouldn't have thought it was that complicated. But that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't either, but you know, I've never been a pre-med. I think this is probably where it breaks down the most. And yeah, like mm-hmm. lab classes, because I know some places have just gotten rid of their labs because doing a lab online is quite difficult, right? So what we're doing is like recording experiments and having them analyze data. Mm-hmm. But the line between that being instructive and that being just busy work is pretty thin.
Yeah.
But some people apparently can't quite graduate if they don't get a certain number of lab courses. So mm-hmm. turns out it's a little more complicated. And, you know, as a teaching assistant, you're not privy to every single detail. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. You don't really get to make all of the end all decisions, et cetera.
Yeah. How about you? Are you teaching?
So I do teaching assistant stuff during the regular semester, like the fall, winter. But in the summer, I usually don't. But I just entered into a weird situation with my supervisor where I'm taking the summer off from my thesis to help with, he's trying to revamp the lab so that people can actually do them at home. Wow. So we were just in a Zoom call. It's a first year course, so it's not really, you don't really need a lot of materials. But we're trying to design a couple labs where we can, you know, create a box of sort of things we can mail to them, like a spring and like a rubber ball, and then collect some apps that they can use to do some measurements and then sort of walk them through plotting so they can do it on their own time in their own house.
Cool.
Yeah, so we have about a week to figure out all of the things we need to buy for the boxes, and then a couple more weeks to put it all together. So we're kind of rushing to get this working, but we're hoping it'll turn out fine. I'm sure it'll be a learning experience for everybody, but I think the upside is pretty good.
My school, actually, they're trying to pilot this thing where some of the labs are being converted into a less of a cookbook format where you do actually, like, there's like setups in the lab, but you just get like a box with a bunch of measuring devices and you have to design your own procedure instead of following what the book tells you. And they've seen, I mean, so someone who works in physics education spent like 6 years of her thesis working on this project, so clearly didn't do it in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But they've definitely seen the student like it. Students like it. Like, I think they get more engagement when students are not being told exactly what to do and have to think on their own. So I'm sure, like, whatever you do, it will give them a distraction, if nothing else. Like, I imagine it would be 10,000 times more fun than watching a video, so.
Yeah, and the way the labs worked already was they did get marks for them, but it was just a completion thing. And they just had a lot of one-on-one time with TAs to sort of work through stuff when they were there. So we're not too concerned about it being like a way for them to get grades or like distinguish A students from B students or anything. So we really are open to, you know, doing whatever makes them learn the most and enjoy themselves, which is nice.
I mean, this is your like standard Patty line about thinking like a scientist, right? Like, a lot of courses teach you how to problem solve in a very algorithmic, step-by-step kind of way. Thinking like a scientist, quote unquote, which is apparently a very marketable skill, is something that's much harder to learn because it's messy and requires time. Doing things at home is definitely messy and requires time and might actually sort of jog that part of your brain a little more.
Yeah, I really want to get them to cook or something. If I had unlimited time to design labs, it would definitely be food-based, but...
I think there's like a physics of food or science of food course at Harvard where they do a little bit of cooking. I saw a presentation at March meeting a couple of years ago. I wasn't like super impressed, but there was definitely hands-on stuff where people got to, you know, spill soup on themselves.
And I think I was at that one. Was that the one in Texas?
I think it was in Boston, but it may be the same person we're thinking of.
Okay. Dave Waits, I think, from Harvard.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. My supervisor loves that guy. We're all in the soft matter, so he's like...
I was just going to say, you know, I briefly entertained doing a soft matter experiment in college, and I remember talking to a professor at UChicago, and he told me, if you can make hollandaise sauce, you can be a soft matter physicist.
Yeah.
It's not very vegan friendly, but I always remembered it because it's probably true. You know, it's an emulsion. That's hard. So there you go.
That's a particularly tricky one. We had a visitor from France come by somewhat recently. He started off doing sort of DNA genetics, then he did a little bit of soft matter, but then he moved completely into food science and he works with like Michelin star restaurants. But
oh my God,
showed us how to make like a meringue in not 5 seconds, but while he was talking, he whipped the whole thing up. Like, he had all these little tricks and stuff. It's kind of the coolest thing ever. Yeah.
Oh, seriously.
So do you want to talk about the conference you're at?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk.
Okay. So I don't know anything about this conference. I didn't hear about it beforehand. I only saw it through your feed. So can you tell me a little bit about
The idea was? It's called Science Talk, which is a nonprofit that was started by a couple years ago because they just saw a space for science communicators to come together. It's based in the Pacific Northwest. I think their headquarters are in Portland. And it seems to be mostly run by volunteers who put ridiculous amounts of work in it, which I think this year was more true than ever. It's pretty high level. There's a lot of professional development stuff. There's a lot of sort of professional journalists who come by. And the way it usually works is you pre-register for workshops. So there's sort of more one-on-one interaction. And then there's big speeches like every conference. And this year they had to go full on virtual, which I think was probably a nightmare for the organizers, but in the end, I think was a real boost to the value of the conference because so many more people could attend. I think by the end of day two, it was something like 260 or 270 people who were watching the live streams and interacting on chat, which is really nice for a somewhat niche conference. And the way they did it virtually is they use Crowdcast, which is this platform that basically lets you live stream, but also have an interactive component in the sense that you can submit polls, you can submit questions, but also there's a chat box that just runs parallel to everything. Okay. So what would happen is someone would be presenting and people were commenting on it in the chat in real time, which I think is something you don't get at a real conference. Real conference as physical conference. So I'm still sort of learning like what good language for this situation is.
Yeah.
I don't want to like say real to downplay like how difficult it must have been to pull this together. But in a physical conference, you know, everyone's kind of sitting in their chairs and maybe you get to ask a question at the end, but you're not necessarily talking to everyone who's sitting around you. I mean, logistically, it would be quite rude if you were talking to everyone who's sitting around you. Mm-hmm. But because virtually, you know, me typing in a chat doesn't interfere with the speaker who's presenting, there was basically 3-4 conversations happening at the same time while we were all still tuned in into the same presentation. So I thought that was remarkably helpful. I am a little bit of an introvert, definitely didn't get to talk to everyone and would have probably talked to much fewer people had I gone in person. And this way, I think people got to like voice opinions that also they may have not been able to say if someone just handed them a mic. So that was super successful. They still left coffee breaks where you could just kind of mingle in a chat room and talk to people. They did breakout sessions where people were just invited to share their screen for a couple minutes, pitch their project. They even did a virtual poster session. So overall, I think it was really sort of a tour de force in how to adapt to new conditions and new technologies and make it work as well as possible. And honestly, there were very few glitches. The platform went down maybe once in the 2 days and very briefly. And the other biggest complaint is that, you know, people's cats kept jumping on their keyboards, but everyone was very into that. So,
yeah. So, yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah.
How long did it take them to convert? Were they like, I know APS canceled around beginning of March, but that seemed like it was one of the first ones that got canceled.
Yeah. So I think they said that grand total, it took them a little over 3 weeks since deciding to go virtual and pulling it together. So really quick turnaround. They did sort of survey everyone who was registered and tried to like gauge how much interest there would be. And then once they did decide to go virtual, registration briefly reopened. So people who wouldn't have been able to travel actually could register and attend virtually, which I think was great. I mean, if I can like briefly get on the soapbox, I think traveling for conferences is much more inconvenient than people think. Like if you are a grad student and don't have money, or if you have kids, or if you're just like chronically ill and hate planes or whatever, like there's a billion reasons why conference travel is difficult and why also like physically being in a room of crowded people may be a challenge. So I think they really took advantage of a bad situation and like let people still join. And towards the end of it, there were a lot of people who were saying exactly that, who were saying, like, had this been in Portland, I would have never gone. But because it was virtual, I could spend 2 days engaging with it. And I think it was very much appreciated. And the fact that they, like, turned it around in 3 or 4 weeks was honestly, like, the really, really impressive.
Yeah. Actually, that's a really good point that you brought up. The whole idea of these virtual conferences being more accessible to all sorts of different people, I think that's probably the most beneficial aspect of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. So like some of my background is like a person in the science community is in sort of equity, inclusion and diversity advocacy. And like you always have this conversation about, you know, is this talk accessible? Can everyone understand this? And we always talk about, you know, like colors on the PowerPoint and closed captioning and whatnot. But the bigger things like, you know, can someone actually be in the room and how can we financially support people? And I very much think that like financial support is a matter of accessibility and equity for sure. That's much harder to address, right? Like even as an organizer, if you have the absolute best intentions, sometimes you're just working within constraints where you can't provide everyone with financial support, or you can't have childcare on site, or you know, you might be in a small room or crowded room or whatever. Like, so I know I co-organized the conference a couple years ago, and we had sign language translators, and we had the quiet room where you could go if you were overwhelmed, and we had a lot of snacks, and you know, you can really sort of try and be thorough, but eventually you hit a point where your own resources don't allow for it. And I think having a virtual component is maybe a more elegant fix than a lot of things that we try to do in person, because I think sort of like meeting people halfway and being like, oh, we're going to be accessible in this and this way, but you still have to sort of grin and bear it through this other thing that may really bother you, is still putting a lot of strain on the person, while as if they can chime in from the comfort of their own home and still feel like they're participating, that's probably optimal. So I really hope that this situation will like teach us all how to use the virtual resources better to actually be accessible versus doing this sort of fudging thing that we have to do. And I mean, I don't want to excuse like big conferences, you know, like March meetings, for instance, probably doesn't have the problem of not being able to be accessible because of resources and such. But I think for a lot of smaller efforts like Science Talk, especially things that are run by volunteers, like I think accessibility is really difficult.
Without having somebody who knows exactly what people need.
Like, yeah,
you can't have a volunteer that represents everybody and knows everything.
Exactly, right? Like ideally you'd, you know, hire someone who's an expert in universal design or a accessibility consultant or something. Like these people are out there and they're very good at what they do, but as a small organizing group, I think it's quite hard. So for sure, like being in a virtual space probably mitigates a lot of that. And I think the organizers for Science Talk were quite aware of that. And, you know, there was a little bit of thing on Twitter where people were like, oh, I'm like attending a conference in my pajamas with my cat in my lap and my favorite tea, and I've never felt so good at a conference, right? Which is probably true for a lot of people who like need accessibility accommodations, but also just like people who may be shy. So that was that really like resonated with me, honestly. Like I was watching it and I was thinking like this is probably like the least exhausted I've felt at a conference, and I'm like the kind of person that has no chill, you know, I like run on caffeine, and I still thought that I benefited from just kind of being at home.
Yeah. I really like the ability to sort of equalize in terms of like financing as well, because I know a lot of people will say that, you know, these in-person conferences are so important for early career scientists because you have all these networking opportunities, but so many early career scientists just don't have the funds to go to a lot of these things. So
I mean, for sure. And you know, a lot of universities do the thing where you can get reimbursed, but that still means that you have to shell out quite a bit of money beforehand, right? So, you know, if I'm buying a plane ticket to Portland and sleeping somewhere for two nights, that's a good chunk of my paycheck, and I may get reimbursed, but maybe in a month or 2 months, or, you know, sometimes these things can be slow. And there's, I don't know how it is at other institutions, but my experience has been, and from talking to other graduate students and postdocs, my experience has been that most places have similar mechanisms where there's very few channels where you can ask for money in advance or have a department like use their travel cards to finance your trip or something, unless you're doing your paperwork like 6 months in advance. And most of us are just not in a position to plan that meticulously. Power to the people who can, for sure. But I am not that person.
No. Yeah, I've heard horror stories of people carrying these enormous credit card bills months and months just because they haven't gotten reimbursed. And
I love that you like highlighted that this is sort of this irony for early career scientists, right? Because especially like towards the end of your PhD, beginning of your tenure track career, like this is exactly what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go and talk to as many people as you can and like make them remember your face. While we, I think as a field, sort of shy away from talking about money in any way, shape or form, there's a little bit of this sort of like, aren't we lucky to get paid to do what we do? And aren't we lucky to go to all these great places? You know, like APS was going to be in Denver this year, and everyone was like, oh my God, Denver mountains, amazing. How great it is that we're going to Denver, but it still costs money to go to Denver, right? So
yeah.
I think you're like on point in like putting emphasis on that.
Yeah, it's, I feel like this is, while a very tragic and scary time, I think that hopefully there's going to be a lot of good that comes out of it. Especially, at least on the conference front, it seems like there's a lot of room for growth there that people are sort of jumping onto, which I'm happy about.
Yeah, no, for sure.
So the conference that you attended, I feel, yeah, actually, that kind of makes sense that they would do such a good job with transitioning. It sounds like there was very much like a how to communicate science. Is that sort of the gist of the conference?
Yeah, so it's supposed to be sort of professional development for people who are interested in science communication and sort of a place to highlight people's particular work. So, okay. You know, the first keynote was by Chris Volpe, who runs a company that does like polling around how the general public thinks about science, right? So it was sort of like, you know, informing science communicators on how to frame their science communication in an effective way, given what we know about, say, how people receive news about scientific topics based on demographics and education and whatnot, right? Like, so that's a very concrete, useful mm-hmm. piece of information if you're a science writer. There were workshops on how to like reach underrepresented and underserved audiences. There were panels on how to find the job in science communication. There was a section about science and art. And then there were a bunch of professional organizations that were sort of giving their pitches. So it was very much sort of like a hub of everything you might want to know about being a science communicator in some semi-professional sense, or just sort of for people like me, if you're trying to get a little bit of a start, like sort of what the best practices are and also just what is out there. There's a lot more clubs and resources and websites that I was aware of for sure that like sort of came under my radar by attending this conference.
Interesting. Was there any particular session or keynote that really stuck out to you that like had a really good take-home message that you were surprised by?
Yeah, so I think that that first keynote was something that I'm sort of still thinking on and trying to sort of figure out how to put it into practice with the kind of science that I do. Because one of the big punchlines was that for most people, when they think about science, they think about it as sort of future-facing. And when they like think about what scientists do, it's always connected to kind of hopes they may have for the future. And I think that's really interesting. I think when we communicate science, and you know, I'm a theoretical physicist, what I do is a little bit disconnected from the real world often. And I think it's easy for us as scientists who are sort of in the thick of it all the time to forget what our big motivation is. Like, I think it's sometimes hard to zoom out and answer the question of like, why even do this? And, you know, for sure, when you write a paper, you write your sort of pitch for why it's important. And then you write the grant, you write your pitch for why it's important. And at every level, you sort of zoom out a little bit more, but you still keep it pretty niche. But in a more like, if I may say, philosophical sense, like, why do we care about learning new things? I think this framing of sort of like science is about our hopes for the future, not necessarily in the way of like science will give us everything that we hope the future will be, but in the sense of like learning new things is always future facing. And just sort of keeping that in mind as we communicate about our projects, that In learning something new in a scientific study, we are sort of paving the way for a future that has more knowledge, that has more information, if nothing else, and then we have a choice of how to act on it. And from this keynote, it seems that, you know, your education level, your political orientation makes a huge difference in how you receive information about science, and especially on controversial topics. So pick your favorite if you want to talk about vaccines or climate change, or even some of the information surrounding the current health crisis, people who are highly educated but highly partisan will usually find a way to use their scientific literacy to sort of do some motivated cognition, to sort of justify their opinion, and think that it's based in science. And I think it can be very discouraging to see that if you're a scientist, to like think that like what people's background is changes the way you do your science so much, even if your science is immaculate. But this frame of sort of even under those circumstances, what we're really talking about when we talk about our work is a more informed, a better future, a future with more knowledge, I think is really uplifting. So I was like very intrigued by seeing that in general, like science equals future kind of translates across all demographics.
That's awesome. I guess I was getting a little bit discouraged kind of recently thinking about basically writing those intros to papers where everything has to be very much like, oh, this is going to help this technology or whatever. And I started maybe thinking that it's really easy to inspire people who just like science for science sake and think it's cool to discover stuff and like learn things. But then there's probably a class of people that really just want to use it as a tool to reach some sort of end. And I think motivating those people to take your science seriously or whatever is very different.
I mean, this was actually touched on that there's a type of person who like associates science with like innovation and competition and being better at building a machine than the other guy. And that there's also a type of person who's like absolutely hates this, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, if you want to upset a certain type of liberal when talking about science, you should talk about exactly what you were just saying, that like science is like for building a thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that is discouraging, like to know that there are like chunks of population who do feel that way, who are like, for whom science and technology are sort of one and the same. Like as a theorist, like I recoil at this a little bit. Like it makes my work feel a little differently than it does when I'm talking to someone who's like, oh my God, you study XYZ. That's amazing, right? I'm not saying it's amazing, but I would still like to study it, you know?
Yeah. I almost feel like, I don't know, this sounds kind of maybe douchey. Capitalism ruined science to some extent. Like you always have to have a bottom line.
I mean, capitalism 100% ruined science, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a scarcity of grants and we all have to fight each other for it. And to fight for a grant, you have to sell your project in a way that you wouldn't otherwise, right?
Yeah, you have to pin like an actual dollar sign onto whatever you do, which is...
Yeah, exactly. I think for there's a type of scientist for whom this is extremely difficult. And, mm-hmm. you know, people... I mean, this is the other thing that I learned at this conference is that like... In some sense, like as a scientist and a science communicator, like you should sometimes think about marketing in a very, very sort of cold sense of like, what is my goal? What's a good strategy for achieving my goal? Who is my audience? How does that inform my strategy, right? Which is, which I think for science communication is a good frame because the goal of communicating is to convey a particular thing. But in doing science, I think if you always have to think of like, how will I market this project? It kind of takes away from just kind of having the freedom to change the project if you find something else that's more interesting, right? Like, and I think this happens a lot in research where you start with one question and then it turns out that you found something very different. And not having the constraint of having been like, we will find XYZ and that will help us build a quantum computer in 10 years, right? Like, I think, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like,
we
have to make these promises that sort of push aside other things that we might have taken up with, dare I say, more joy had we had more resources.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm pretty lucky. My supervisor had a very comfortable... or continues to have a very comfortable tenure position and just loves the exploratory, like going to the lab, break some stuff, find a new project. I don't know, just sort of explore and have fun. That's 100% like the way that he goes about his research. But watching, he started a startup recently and seeing based off one of these projects where, you know, another student kind of just stumbled upon a thing, but seeing how he operates in the academic sense versus like the startup, it's completely different. And yeah, I guess that might have been the thing that's put that into my head a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think like also scientists, we don't really get taught how to be business people or marketing people or, you know. Mm-hmm. I think like within academia, we still operate on this assumption of something like purity, where like if you're just good enough at your science, that will get you far. And I think the world is changing enough that just being good at science is not always quite enough to make it in the sense of securing funding to keep doing the science that you like. And I think in this sense, like having a little bit of exposure to like how science communication works in a more professional sense is actually really beneficial. Like learning how to talk about your science in a way that's not only accessible, but also like thought through, right? Like if you're writing a popular science piece about an experiment, you're going to think about your language much more deliberately than if you're talking to a fellow, I don't even want to say a scientist, right? Because if you told me about your research, I probably wouldn't understand anything because you and I do very different kinds of physics. And that's a very small degree of separation compared to if I were talking to, I don't know, like a biologist or something, right? Mm-hmm. So I think like even the way we talk to each other changes, but I think, you know, having to put pen to paper and be like, I will purposely write this in a language that a person from X demographic will understand actually gives you a huge advantage. So I've like over the last few years, I very much thought that like, if we're going to live in this environment where we have to fight for funding, we should all get some basic education and like just how to communicate better. And even if we're not going to fight for funding, we should all still learn how to communicate better, because I think like making our science more accessible could, for one, inspire more people, and for two, just kind of like force us also to be more connected to the big picture, to why we're doing all of this beyond that first paragraph in the paper, which you're writing for the editor anyway, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, bring more awareness that there are people who aren't exactly like me doing it for the same reasons that I'm doing it. It can only be beneficial. Well, that's cool. So you said that this conference was supposed to be in Portland, but it was all online. Is this a yearly thing? Are you going to sign up again for next year?
I might try. I think it was really fun. And they also said that they are considering next year doing it in person and online at the same time. So still providing the virtual platform that they set up for this year. As the talks happen in Portland. So that's okay. An option. Again, like if I don't have to travel, it's much easier to put it in my schedule, right?
Yeah.
And you know, Science Talk is they're a nonprofit. I want to support them for sure. I think the work that they're doing is tremendous, like bringing together like 260 people for a conference. And, you know, they had some professional editors and professional journalists, and, you know, they had a couple of people with background in communications and psychology who were talking sort of about how to deal with communicating about the current crisis. They had people who do comics. They had people who written books, really like some very high powered people. And if someone could put all those people in one room, I really want to support that. I think that's very much worthwhile. Like it's forging connections and networking in a professional sense, but I think it's also community building. And we need that. I think we need community as scientists and as science communicators. And ideally those two would also intersect, which I think we saw a lot of, or I saw a lot of at that conference, but I'm sure you've had this experience too, right? That like people who do communication also usually do science and really care about it at a whole other level, and that community needs to be there too.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so cool that they got so many people that do so many different things. That's
yeah, really no, great. I was like super impressed. It was really inspiring. Like I was honestly, like going into it, I was like, oh my God, am I gonna sit in my kitchen for 8 hours and just like watch people talk at me? Am I even gonna make it through this? You know, I had a cup of coffee and a cup of tea and a glass of water and a snack, like I like prepared for war. And then it was just like really uplifting. And at the end of the second day, they were like, okay, we're all going to leave our video on and I'm going to, and they played some music and like showed the disco ball. And they were like, now dance in your kitchen and, you know, feel connected. And, you know, I'm not a dancer. I wasn't dancing in my kitchen, but it was such a nice note to end on. It like really felt like, okay, this wasn't just me sitting here staring at a screen.
That's so really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like there's so many different outreach or communication things that are happening, just like connecting them all is really a worthwhile goal.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I do a lot of this. Like, I'm an officer in a grad student union. I run a mentoring program. I consult for a network of mentoring programs nationally. I like do a lot of women and gender minority stuff. Like, I'm like pretty steeped in this stuff, and mm-hmm. it still very often feels separated. Where, you know, I'm taking like, especially now that like we've moved everything to Zoom, I'm like Zooming with a different group of organizers a couple times a week. And I do occasionally have those moments where I'm like, what if we all just actually talk to each other? And maybe like being forced to using more virtual spaces to being more connected across distances will give us the tools that we need to do more of those intersectional things and to sort of also share resources. I think, you know, a lot of organizing efforts that happen on college campuses, if you require like financial support, and I hate to be coming back to this, but as you were saying, capitalism ruined everything, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's much harder to get someone to give you money to, I don't know, like run a virtual town hall versus being able to say, we'll buy pizza for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. So I think in some sense, like sharing resources and teaching each other how to use different platforms. Like for our union, we did a town hall a couple of weeks ago and we like did it on Twitch. And none of us really knew how to use Twitch before because we're not gamers, but we learned. And I wonder like what other things there are to learn and which other organizer has figured it out already and could like give us a hint, right? So, mm-hmm. so I think there's space. There's a silver lining in this situation is that maybe we'll learn from each other. Maybe we'll connect more. We're all at home anyway, right? So
yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I mean, I'm talking to you on Zoom, right? Like I probably have done that otherwise.
Yeah, I'm impressed with Zoom. I didn't know that existed until I guess the beginning of this month, but it seems like it's a really robust and works really well for large groups of people. I'm impressed.
Yeah. I mean, my husband and I were like Zooming with his niece, who's like 8 years old a couple days ago. And then the next day I was like teaching a college class on quantum mechanics on the same platform. I was like, this is honestly kind of incredible. Like, you know how yeah. people say like, this is not the dystopian future I signed up for. Like, this is the part of the dystopian future I think I did sign up for, where like I can connect with a very wide variety of people without having to have like 700 apps for it. So
yeah,
sure, Zoom is evil in some way. And there are like rumors about privacy concerns, but so far it's also really been like, I'm glad we have this.
Yeah, for sure. It's almost too easy.
There you go. You see, this is what I mean.
Cool. Well, I think maybe I should let you go. But yeah, thanks again for talking to me. This was really interesting. And I'm definitely going to check out the organizers and stuff that we're putting on your conference. It seems like a really worthwhile thing to support.
Yeah, for sure. I'm like sure they'd be happy to talk to you. Also, you want to talk to Allison Coffin? Or the other person, she goes by Kiki, I forget her full name, but if you like go to Science Talks website, you can probably look up the whole team.
Okay.
It's like three or four people who basically do everything, and they are also all pretty much professional scientists. So I'm sure they'd be delighted to
give
you more info. Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me. This was a nice conversation.
Yeah, this was really good. We should talk more or something.
We should totally talk more. Yeah, for sure.
All right, great. And you don't mind if I post this on YouTube or
no, like I mean, go for it. This is not a time to be vain. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'll give you all the links and stuff as soon as the stuff is up. And okay. Yeah, enjoy your meeting later today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, talk to you later.
See ya.